This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā, tēnā koutou katoa, no mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. Welcome to Speak Up Kōrero Tia. I'm your host, Sally Carlton, and today we're talking Suffrage 125, 125 years since women were granted the vote in New Zealand. Pretty exciting that we're recording this in Christchurch, hometown of Cape Shepherd, that suffrage heroine. And also pretty cool that the show happens to air on the 19th of September, which is the exact date, 125 years after Lord Glasgow, Governor of New Zealand at the time, signed a new electoral act which made New Zealand the first self-governing country in the world to give women the right to vote in parliamentary elections. This show is proudly supported by the Ministry for Women's Suffrage 125 Community Fund. We've got three guests here. I'm really excited to be introducing you all. I think this is going to be a fantastic discussion. Vanessa, perhaps we'll start with you. Vanessa Dero.
Kia ora. Great to be with you all today and a momentous day 125 years later on from suffrage.
Would you like to tell us some of your many, many hats that you wear?
My first hat that I'm wearing predominantly today and this month is as the president of the National Council of Women New Zealand. So our organisation was founded by the suffragists and our founding president was Kate Shepherd. So a real pleasure and honour to be filling her shoes. I'm not sure if I fill them well, but I'm certainly giving it a shot. I'm also involved on a day-to-day level in a paid capacity as the community manager for Internet New Zealand. And I sit on a number of advisory groups for government agencies and other non-profits around the country.
Great, thank you. How about Katie Pickles?
Kia ora. I'm Katie. I'm a professor at the University of Canterbury and my job description is proudly women/feminist history. I think it's the only job that's been advertised as that in the country thus far. And I'm a current James Cook Research Fellow at Te Raparangi Royal Society New Zealand looking at changes in women's status over the last 125 years. So I'm usually stuck in the past, but at the moment I'm just looking at the passing of the 1919 Parliamentary Act that allowed women the right to stand for Parliament.
Very, very apt for today's topic. And I contest a bit what you said there. I think that lots of your research actually has so much relevance for today.
Well, yeah, if we don't know about the past, if we don't really get to the present, do we all make the future?
And finally, Kim Hamilton.
Kia ora, morena koutou. Kia ora, Sally. My iwi affiliations are Ngāti Kahunga Nungaro Rua Ngāti Raukawa, but I'm lucky enough to be working down here with Ngāi Tahu in an organisation called Tokuna Te Raki. So our work is focusing on equity for Māori in Te Waipounamu in South Island and income, education and employment by 2040. And yes, I'm a mother of three sons and I call myself, work title is Kaiputahi, which I kind of loosely translate to number one gun. So yeah, just really great to be here. Another part of my work, well, actually my volunteer work is on the technical advisory group for the monitoring mechanism for the Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. So I guess that's how I came to be here. So thanks Jess Ngātai from Human Rights for suggesting me to come along.
You did come very highly recommended. Now, just to get this discussion underway, it would be fantastic to hear, possibly from you, Katie, at least to start with, a little bit about the history of women's suffrage, what's happened to bring this all about.
Wow, in a nutshell, how long have we got? Okay, so what happened in a nutshell was there was a lot of agitation around the Western world about liberty, egality, fraternity, arising from Enlightenment thinking, to put it that way. First it was the men who were going to get universal suffrage, then lots of men and women too started agitating for women to get it too. You jump into the context of colonizing New Zealand society, don't you, where you have the colonial invader power coming in with those ideas. and setting up governments. We go to provincial to national. And so from that point, there's this, it's very much this Western egalitarian liberal, is the right word, it's a liberalism idea. You then get women who are able to have the time and the effort to agitate for it. They're usually the middle class to upper class women. They find themselves thinking, how can we make society a better place? And you get the most notable, of course, famous one is Kate Shepard, but there are many other women like her around. I'm interested in the transnational. You can see it plays into this definitely, doesn't it? It's not ideas or theories that originate here. They're largely imported into the colonial context that's happening. And you get Mary Levitt visiting, who's the president from the United States of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And suffrage gets tied into the whole settling of society. So it's part of the colonial endeavour that way. And in particular, bringing order through women's newfound morality that's happening at the time throughout North America, the UK, so forth. So then it starts to happen through peaceful, largely agitation, petitioning, writing letters campaign. And it's the third attempt that passes in Parliament. It passes when, it's quite interesting, it's actually the Conservative politicians who are the more keen because they think it will settle society, and they're not very pleased that the rowdy men have got the vote while the lovely moral women don't. So it eventually just passes in 1893, and that's how we get to that point.
That was a very good summary. I always think about the kind of, it's almost a bit of a myth or a legend about the however many thousand signature petition being rolled down the steps of Parliament.
Yes, and it's true that a quarter of the population, women population at the time, signs that petition. And that is, it sort of symbolises that peaceful gathering, hard work going around getting these signatures on it, and that it's a mass movement. The idea's been around for a long time, the idea's around other places. It's sort of a natural progression is the word that's used. Natural's used a lot. And the wheelbarrow wheeling it in saying, look, how can you resist this? And of course, the most resistance comes from the liquor lobby, and that says it all, really, and that whole context of settling, improving society for women and men and family life through prohibition, through temperance. So that's how it happens here as part of the argument.
And when that law was passed, so 19th of September 1893, it gave the right to vote to all women of European and Māori descent, as far as I'm aware, but women of other ethnicities were not included?
I know, you said that, and I must admit I'd never heard that before. Where did you find, because that's something,
I saw that as well.
Te Ara, I think.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I'd also heard when I was studying at university under Tanya Ray, who was speaking about Māori women in the vote, and she spoke about it in her lectures, about Kate Shepard didn't have any particular passion for Māori women getting the vote, was my understanding at the time.
Yeah. I've heard slightly different opinions, because of course Mere Teta Mangatahia, who led the Māori Christian Temperance Union when Kate was the legislative secretary for the Women's Christian Temperance Union, the Pākehā body, I understood that they had worked together to try and gain some of the signatures to the vote. So I think our history is also a little bit muddled, and you know, we need to go back to our whakapapa and understand perhaps a little bit more as we go through this year.
And the quotes that there are, because I've been really interested in trying to find out more about the whole relationship. It's often in photographs as well, where you see the Women's Christian Temperance Union on Marae and so forth. So there's definitely a lot of history there, and it turns into the Māori Women's Welfare League. All of that history is starting to be thought of, what we might call cultural contact and exchange and all those ideas that are happening. But the things that we do know of what Kate Shepard said is she didn't want to be prejudiced about anyone. She talks about creed and so forth in a lot of her writing. So it doesn't really make sense that she would be anti any, we're calling it ethnicity or grouping. She didn't like political parties either. She was anti groups in quite a sort of radical way. So I don't think she had any hate.
The way I had understood it was, if you were a British subject, that included people of European descent and Māori descent, but other ethnicities, not so.
And
that's how it was defined.
And that's the law versus coming from the women. All the evidence that I have seen is Aotearoa New Zealand versus, say, Canada, is that there was actually a lot more interaction comparatively. It doesn't make things perfect or in the context of their times, but I've been trying to look and I haven't found any written statements. And in fact, the photographs are quite interesting to look at, the few of them that have survived.
It'd be a great discussion anyway, why are women left out? But I guess my real interest is, what does suffrage mean? What does it mean today? What does it mean in terms of the status of Māori women today? And it hasn't really achieved a lot for us if you're looking at what's happening in New Zealand society. And, as British subjects, Māori men went away to fight for equal rights, and I don't think that's really been realised in Aotearoa. So, I'm keen on having a bit more of a discussion around those things.
Definitely, as we move forward, I think we'll focus more on contemporary. But I just want to get back to a point you made, Vanessa, which is thinking about this year and maybe trying to look at history again. Any suggestions on how we do that? I mean, Katie, you've been doing research and you haven't seemed to find much concrete information one way or the other. What do we do from here?
Well, I think particularly with our Māori stories is we need to go, and I know that many of the families connected with Meri Tētai have started asking for some of that kōrero to come through and be recorded in some, oral history or film footage. And for us to really kind of make sure that we can wait and listen to what those stories perhaps suggest what has happened in our history. I would like to just also mention that the suffrage petition, which is now located in the National Library as part of the He Tohu exhibition, has been collecting a number of the stories of the woman that actually signed that petition. And so anyone is able to submit a story about any of those signatures. And what we do know about some of the signatures is that many of the Māori women that did sign were signing under Pākehā names, or names that perhaps they might not have identified within their Māoridom. And so I think we've got some interesting history to start unpacking, and hopefully we'll be able to resolve some of that work and some of those thoughts going forward.
Exciting stuff. Okay, well, we'll have our first song, which I think very appropriately, Katie, you've chosen Sister Suffragette from the film Mary Poppins, which I think partly was in jest, but Kim's
well,
giving a high five.
I have, because I was just saying, I really wanted the Luke Desoma, didn't I, from that Bloody Woman, the Enough song, because I thought that was good. But yeah, this was my
backup. Yeah. But I think this is great because, for me anyway, as a child, this is the first exposure I had to the suffrage movement. My mum explaining what is it that she's doing stomping around the house. So hopefully, I'm sure others had the same experience. Anyway, here's the song.
We're clearly soldiers in petty coats and dauntless crusaders for women's votes. Though we adore men individually, we agree that as a group they're rather stupid. Cast off the shackles of yesterday, shoulder to shoulder into the fray. Our daughters' daughters will adore us, and they'll sing in grateful chorus. Well done, Sister Suffragette. From Kensington to Billingsgate, one hears the restless cries from every corner of the land. Womankind, arise! Political equality and equal rights with men. Take heart, for Mrs. Pankhurst has been clapped in irons again. No more the meek and mild subservience we. We're fighting for our rights militantly. Never you fear! Shackles of yesterday, and shoulder to shoulder into the fray. Our daughters' daughters will adore us, and they'll sing in grateful chorus. Well done, well done, well done, Sister Suffragette.
Now, my heart, am I? Kei te whakarongo koutou ki te hōtaka Speak Up Kōrerotia. You're listening to Speak Up Kōrerotia. We're with Kim Hamilton, Vanessa Diru and Katie Pickles talking Suffrage 125. Katie, you were just talking about songs and how songs might be a lens into suffrage back in the day, and particularly the idea of the bicultural relationship.
If we're talking about how we get into the past, and often we can't find it in the written record, they can have their limits. So often we'll look to, say, photographs or in particular late 19th century that can often really give you a glimpse. But one of the other aspects is music, and music can often go transculturally. It's a whole form, isn't it, of tradition and history that we can overlook. And we're just saying that in the early 1890s, we would bet that the women are singing, and so there's a lot more room for work to be done revealing those songs. They could be hymns, it's quite likely, that have been adapted. They could be a form of waiata and hymn put together. You know, I can quite imagine that that is where, if we're looking for encounter and meeting of particular perspectives, that could be where they happened.
Well, apparently they were singing in the 1890s. There was a collection of suffrage songs put together in 1993, and this year to mark the celebrations, they're being recomposed and reimagined at an event in Wellington.
Because we know another way that happens is through dress, isn't it, and clothing and the demonstration that were happening in the form of badges. I mean, we have camellia here, don't we? We can implant it. That's ecological imperialism. But so talking about ways we get to the past, and I think in ways that engage perhaps younger generations who are interested in coming to this from a new angle, and one of those ways is music.
Exciting idea again. Well, I'd like to move us now from looking at the past to more looking at the present, and where is New Zealand now in terms of women's rights? Suffrage, I feel, is often cited as, you know, New Zealand was the first in the world and how fantastic is that, which is great. But on the other hand, we also have to be progressing with our human rights achievements, and I think that's happening less. So I just open the floor to any of you to talk about where do we think New Zealand is with rights, and particularly women's rights at the moment.
The stats for Māori women, and I've always had this discussion with politicians or senior bureaucrats around, you know, if we really want to look at, you know, the progress that New Zealand has made as a nation and as a society, we really need to look at what's happening to the status of the Indigenous woman, status of Māori women. I think that's true internationally as well, if you really want to look at it. And often we say we want to look at what's happening to our children, but, you know, children and women are so intrinsically tied, I don't think there's very much difference. I'm really disturbed by some of the social statistics that sit around our people at the moment. In particular, the incarceration rate, 65% of women in prison are Māori. Those are issues for me. Domestic violence statistics are problematic. Well, how many Māori are voting? And actually, there's about 30% that aren't voting. And for 18 to 24-year-olds, that's 40% of Māori are not voting. So, you know, what was it for? And what is the system that we're actually upholding through the vote? So these kind of things are going through my head as well. You know, New Zealand's lauded because we have a female prime minister and blah, 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 and, you know, women holding a lot of top positions. And there's, I guess, this myth around the trickle-down effect of corporate feminism and how it impacts ordinary people, you know, struggling to get through life. And that truly doesn't happen. It doesn't happen in New Zealand. And I think we're kind of fooling ourselves a little bit. And I'd like to see a little bit more discussion around the intersect between race, gender and class. It seems like we hold up these feminist, white feminist ideals, and often they're clashing when we start to, you know, align it with issues of race and class, you know. And if there are issues to do with Māori women and that are kind of visited on by society, and I think Marshall Gantz has a great quote which says, to look at disparity without an equity lens is to see broken people and not a broken system. And I think that's often what we see. We see broken people, and we're not really looking at what's happening to create those things.
I was just thinking about the idea of intersectionality, and I'd probably also add age and ability or disability into the mix of the intersections that we're having trouble with. I also don't feel that every conversation in this suffrage year or feminist movement right now is encapsulating difficulties that many of our new migrant communities and, you know, first, second and third generation migrant communities as well, add the refugee community, former refugees in here as well. And, you know, we've got layered problems that we need to overcome. And I think so much of that is about how do we share those issues and stories from real people around the challenges that they face. I often share with people The challenges that, you know, I might face, both my first name and last name are not easy to spell in this country, but go to any other part of the world and people would be able to pronounce my surname correctly and know what it means. And, you know, once people see my name on my CV, if I'm applying for a new role, you know, making an assumption that I wasn't born here, and quite clearly you can hear from my accent, born and bred in the Manawatū, second generation, and, you know, judgments being pushed on me just because of very simple things like my name, which means, you know, so much more to me and my family, of course. So I think if we're able to share more of those stories around intersectional challenges and get people to really understand how we might be able to overcome that within the feminist movement, there are certainly things that the National Council of Women is looking to overcome in the work that we do, but many other organisations that are affiliated with us, the 50 national groups, are also looking to see how they can help with that kōrero as well.
I've been reading Lean Out by Dawn Foster, and it's kind of affected me on quite a visceral level because she speaks about the status of women in England, really, and she writes for The Guardian. And she's got a quote in there that says, "Expecting women of disparate social status to hold their breath while forcing a few women at the top and hoping the benefits trickle down to their level at some point is as patronising as it is opportunist for wealthy and more privileged women." And the other comment that she makes is that there's no intrinsic tendency for women to support other women when competing class and power interests offer far more fruitful personal rewards. And I think, you know, we don't talk to that. We actually don't talk about sharing power. We might talk about sharing stories and, you know, all the stuff that's kind of easy to do, but we don't talk about social justice and sharing power. So I would like to see more discussions at a societal level, at a community level, at a political level about those things.
Yes, and I think Kate Shepherd would absolutely agree with you, because that I think she was quite a visionary in her view of what society would be, and that was exactly what she was trying to do, wasn't it? That's why the National Council of Women came into existence. I think Vanessa would agree with me. Yeah, and I'm quite fascinated. Kate Shepherd was an immigrant. It's not a part of her story that is often spoken about. I know when I'm lecturing about her, I always talk about this and how she came here in her early 20s and had, you know, the accent of elsewhere. I think it's something that's really important to the story. Some of the iconography constructing him makes us sort of into the Pākehā ideal citizen and part of that Anglo-Celtic dominant state. You know, that was what she sort of became, but she was definitely an immigrant that way and tapped into all sorts of international circuits and so forth. And as her life went on, she identified very much as an international citizen, and through all her work that she did back in Britain as well. So I think it's an aspect of her that's really important and perhaps relatable and that we need to remind ourselves of. And the other aspect is the petition, which Sally mentioned before, and I'm always very uncomfortable. I just got an email from Tertiary Education Union, and it was like, come on, like your great-grandmothers did, sign the petition. And instantly, if your great-grandmothers didn't, because they weren't here, it comes from James Balich and the great Pākehā peopling of the late 19th century, and when that whole character of the country that is this very Anglo-Celtic dominant thing sets in. And I think when suffrage gets tied into that, as it often does, that creates awkwardness. And it's not really, if you look back, what that situation was at that time. It's what's come afterwards. If you look at the ministry site, there's an attempt to sort of move beyond that image of the way things were. Why is it those of us who didn't have great-grandmothers here, or whoever we are and however long this might have been our home, just pop along and sign the petition? It should be a living petition that anyone who wants to can just add their name to. It's that idea of being excluded from that group at that time that I think creates that othering, dare I say it.
This all comes back to the system, I think, doesn't it, Kim? Yep. Just kind of what you were talking about.
Yep. I'll just put in a plug there too. You know, we have Māori women who definitely led a lot of struggles similar to those that Kate Shepherd led, and you know, Te Puia Hirangi, yes, is a fantastic example of women who really led movements across the country for Māori in terms of anti-conscription, but also around looking after community, keeping community strong. Yes. Well, the other thing too is that we pick up these people who are famous, but actually this was the work of the collective. Mm. This was actually the work of the many, you know.
I've had students for 20 years doing essays comparing Tupuria and Kate Shepherd as heroines of a similar era and of well-being, and a lot of their beliefs, and looking at what they believed in and what they were doing, and why is it that Kate Shepherd becomes the mainstream known name, and Tupuia, well, at the time, though, she is quite well known, and you can trace it through the years and so forth. But and that's where I think, yeah, there was an interaction often through the Women's Christian Temperance Union early on, and then as Māori Women's Welfare League and so forth. But yeah, absolutely, the students love thinking about that. Yeah.
And I'd just add also, I know, you know, the social construct is Kate Shepherd and her petition. However, you know, to try and get 32,000 plus signatures right around the country, that's an organised effort. And if there's anything that I would take from the suffrage movement of 1893 and the two petitions prior that didn't quite make it to get that change, is that there were hundreds of women right around the country that were helping do that. Clara Alley, Ada Wells, Anna Stout, Kate Shepherd, Margaret Sevright, but a few names that helped do that. And actually it's the power of the collective, as you've mentioned, that is really, really important to think about when we reflect on suffrage this year.
Yes, absolutely. And it's what Kim's saying, isn't it, about women working together. And
exactly.
And it's, for me, what stands out about Aotearoa New Zealand, and when you go elsewhere, I always remember when I turned up in London once and one of my brothers was there and he said, "Oh, Katie, you're not going to like it here." I said, "Why not, Tom?" He said, "Oh, it's just sexist. They just don't respect their women. Look at this advertising." And this is my accountant brother, and he'd sniffed out that I think we should be incredibly proud, although there are all these differences and it's not perfect here. There is that kind of, it's a platform of women working together, and that it was a mass movement. That's what's to be proud of, that spirit. That's the egalitarian spirit that probably no one would really disagree with. It's that idea of not being prejudiced.
For me, it was meant to be a struggle for equality, and we're a hell of a long way away from that. If we look at the reason Māori men went to war, it was, you know, because they thought that that would guarantee their children, their grandchildren, equal rights and citizenship. But it never really eventuated for our people.
You're thinking of imperial and patriotic sense that way. But I think if we look at gender equity, New Zealand is one of the best countries in the world. Even though it's not perfect, and it's not, some people might say it's got a lot of problems, I think there's a lot of entrenched prejudice elsewhere as well as here, and here has tried to get it right.
What leads you to think that, Katie? What would be the measurement?
I was just looking at the entrance of women's right to vote. That would be the one. So being first, like being the first to do it, that actually, it's sort of like, how did that happen? It's one of the key indicators, isn't it, of women becoming equal in a liberal society.
You know, given our history, yes, we might have been first. But, I mean, looking at our ranking in the gender equality statistics of the OECD, I mean, we've slipped to ninth in the world, a country that enabled all of our citizens to vote. So going to ninth is a major shift. Mm. And I think, you know, the major challenges are with our Māori wahine, our Pacifica communities, and some of our other communities that are really facing challenges, particularly in pay, with access to education, access to opportunities, I guess even just access to be able to share their voices and thoughts. We don't see their voices or see their faces around these conversations and circles enough in this country to enable that to be seen.
I think that's a fantastic point, Vanessa, and leads in really well to our next segment, gender equality in New Zealand and basically where are we at. Kim, you chose our next song, which is System Virtue by Emma Paki.
I love the video. It came out in 1993, and you see a cross-section of Aotearoa New Zealand. You see lots of brown faces, lots of state house communities, and she sings about the struggle but also about the hope. And I think I have a tendency to get caught up in the struggle myself and just get kind of a little bit fed up about that. And she's got such a beautiful beautiful, beautiful voice. I think she's a really underrated songwriter, and she made a beautiful contribution around the time of that album. I think she's just fantastic.
Perfect, thank you. We're talking about Suffrage 125, and in this segment we're hoping to look specifically at the idea of gender equality in Aotearoa New Zealand. What is it? Where are we at? And Vanessa, you might be a good person to kick us off, because the National Council of Women is leading what's being called the Gender Equal New Zealand movement. It would be fantastic to hear exactly what it is, why you think it's needed.
So a few years back, when the National Council of Women sort of really hit rock bottom and tried to work out what we wanted to do for New Zealand going forward, we thought about all of those issues that many of us know about: pay equity, access to education, access to healthcare, issues around domestic violence and other gender inequalities, and thought, you know, as an organisation that represents 50 other national groups and a variety of branches across the country, perhaps representing the views of over 350,000 people, what is the one thing that we could do that could help all of those issues and support those members doing the work that they're doing? And for us, it was around cultural change. So how can we change the attitudes and behaviours of New Zealanders that are in influencer-level roles, that are parents, that are leaders in our communities and our whānau and our groups that have something to say about change in this country? And what we thought was, let's start a campaign called Gender Equal New Zealand. And really it's around questioning the status quo. Do we think equality today is reality? And really close to that, we know that there are ideas about what makes a real man or a real woman, and those ideas are quite limiting. They don't allow most people to express who they are, and the reality is that most people have both sorts of characteristics of being more masculine or more feminine, and that's great. However, masculinity is put up on a pedestal, whereas the femininity is certainly not. And what we're trying to challenge is, well, actually, how do we get through to become a gender equal New Zealand, where New Zealanders right around this country, no matter who you are, have the freedom to determine your own future, free of any gender stereotypes or constraints. And we believe really to shift our deep-seated sexist attitudes and assumptions, we've got to highlight the real state of inequality in this country and get people to really think, what can we do going forward?
I particularly liked when I was looking at it that it seems to be you're not just talking about women or femininity, but also men and masculinity. And I think if women are to get equal rights, it has to be in partnership with men.
Yes, and I think we also need to be conscious of all the other genders that are now in society. So we don't talk about binary. And thinking about, 3.7% of secondary school students describe themselves as trans or not sure of their gender, which basically means 1 in 25 of our young people don't feel like the gender that they were ascribed to at birth tells the whole story about who they are. So how do we help all of our young people going forward, but also all of the people that we have in our country, to aspire to do whatever it is that they wish they want to do? And allowing them to dream that they could do whatever they want despite whatever gender they ascribe to.
I do think it's interesting when we talk about women's rights today, given that gender is no longer seen as binary.
I think it's around the, various people have got views on contemporary feminism and how do we progress that conversation, because many of us thinking about this really clearly believe that a good feminist or a great feminist would think of equality for all. And knowing that a lot of our issues are harder for women and girls, they are much harder for many others in other parts of society and life, depending on where you are and in what state that particular part of society is enacting. It's a major subject, right? Mm. It's a big deal for our young people. Who wants to tell their young children that one day the female, the family, is going to get paid less than the male? No one. The language that we use, we don't want our parents to say when a dad stays at home that he's babysitting and when a mum stays at home, she's just being a mum. No one is just a mum. You are a mother. You're never just a mother. And certainly if you're a father, you're not babysitting. You are being a father and being a dad. And those are equal partnerships, that I believe are really important to ingrain in our societies going forward. And it's language that drives culture, and we need to change that behaviour and attitude to get that culture to be more positive in this country.
I've been attached to Women's Refuge for a while, and in terms of Māori Women's Refuge as well, and it was interesting because the cornerstones of the refuge have been feminism, biculturalism, collectivism and lesbianism as kind of four cornerstone values. Mm. And I've seen both the positive sides to those things and how we define them, and the limiting sides to those things. We've got a word, tino rangatiratanga, and I think that's a word that can apply to everyone. And in discussions that I've had with my supervisor some 16 years ago at Vic, you know, rangatiratanga is about, you know, your self-determination with yourself, your whānau, your people. But tino rangatiratanga is really about what you give to others, your capability and capacities for sharing and leading others. And I think those are the challenges for us as Māori. If we get to a status or a state where we are able to be have tino rangatiratanga with other cultures, that would be amazing for New Zealand. And I think those are also kind of practices that every culture in New Zealand wants to see. The other thing that I was thinking about was, you know, I think we need to just be real about what the struggles are and talk to those intersections. I also think that there's lots of opportunities through creative art and the stories that Katie and Vanessa talked about as well to create change. I think there's some great work going on in terms of things like the diversity agenda that's happening for, you know, some professions. You know, I think diversity and embracing diversity and actually New Zealand's mindset accepting diversity, knowing that our demographics are significantly changing. In the South Island, the Māori population is going to grow by 80%. For every white child born, there's going to be a brown child, an Asian child, a Pacifica, a Māori, you know. So New Zealand is coming for a great population change, and unless we can create the sort of country that we think we have, we would like to have, then, you know, it's not going to be a great place to live.
And so many of us and our families and whānau came to this country. I mean, I think of my own family came here from India, hopefully to have a better life. I mean, certainly to raise myself and my brother. My parents made that decision very clearly early on, thinking that they would have, you know, we would have much greater respect and opportunities in this country than we would if we grew up in India. And so many families that now live here have got that similar background and similar thinking. And that's certainly, I mean, I think everyone in this country wants to live in a great country, but we've got to work out how do we get that great country. Mm. And that, you know, that is about driving culture to become more positive around opportunities for across genders.
One of the historical arguments about what we might call the spirit of equal opportunity and having a country, the language they have, inclusivity, the arguments made that it comes down to the time of settlement here, and that those who came here and the colonisers weren't, their mindset was very much influenced by the end of slavery, by reform that was taking place in parts of Europe. It's often been given as a reason for this grand liberalism and this idea of creating God's own country and so forth. And as we've been saying, of course, by today's terms, it doesn't seem perfect at all, but there has always been, I think, that spirit. I'm very interested in what I see as an ongoing difficulty, which is that division that is still drawn between public and private spheres in a very essential way. And we know that it's a theory. We know realities are not like that. And the feminist catchphrase, the personal is political, that was around a lot, I think it's as important as ever today. And we see attempts at trying to be more honest, perhaps, when people are public figures and they do talk more about their private. But it's a bit of a situation of damned if you do and damned if you don't still, I think, because most people think in these binary terms of public and private. And the difficulty is that that's where a liberal tradition comes from. The idea of women becoming equal is that women will go from the private to the public, from the private house of their home to the public house of governance. So I think we still get tripped up a lot by that liberal ideology. I think until we move beyond that, and it's interesting that sexuality is doing it because it's moving to being a continuum. So we're talking about individuals moving beyond a binary mindset, we might call it. But I think society very much, we still have that idea of you are out to work or you're at home. And, of course, that's some of the work that the National Council of Women has done forever, isn't it? It's known that women's work, whether it be unpaid or paid, is work. So challenging all those. And that's where, Kim, what you're saying about rangatiratanga and perhaps thinking about how we can do things differently here, I think it's really important based on new understandings.
Well, it might be time for our final song. We've got Vanessa's choice, also very appropriate for today, God is a Woman by Ariana Grande.
You love it how I move you. You love it how I touch you, my one. When all is said and done, you will believe God is a woman. And I feel it after midnight.
Speak Up Cordero Tia, and just to finish off our discussion on Suffrage 125, we've got a few minutes left to talk about what do you hope for Aotearoa? What would a gender equal, and not just a gender equal, but a equal society in New Zealand look like to you?
I guess one of the things we talk about in terms of te reo is that, you know, the kids that are coming through who can speak te reo today, they don't really care about the struggle that went on. What they want to know is how can they use te reo today and what can it do for them. And I think what is coming through in terms of some of the gender and some of the struggles that we talk about, the younger generation, those who are coming through school and education today, don't see it the same way that we do. They don't see it in terms of those struggles. So I invest a lot of hope and I just see the huge possibilities because they don't see things the way we do. They're not fixed in terms of those binary experiences and the struggle hopefully won't be quite as difficult for them because that's just not normal. They don't play by the same rules that we did.
I'd like to see an end to entrenched prejudices that I see coming in from elsewhere, especially through media and so forth, that sort of derivative sense of culture and belonging. There are many beauties, aren't there, of more communication around the world, but I think when we're talking about where perhaps Aotearoa New Zealand might have slipped a bit in the last half century, I think it's through communication change you can get these prejudices coming in that perhaps are harmful. And I'd like to see equal opportunity for everyone. I think opportunity is a key word we should talk about. It's really equal opportunity, and that should apply to every human being.
Power yeah. sharing? Yeah. The sharing of power?
Yeah, I'm ditto above prejudice, power sharing. And I'd just add to that, you know, if we could break down rigid expectations around gender, we'd create a lot more room for everybody in society. Mm. So if we could get rid of the norms that cause, you know, gender-based violence, pay inequality, devaluing caregiving work, parenting inequalities and leadership roles, you know, just to name a few of those things, we would have change in our world for the better. And I guess, you know, I'd reflect on the very famous Kate Shepard quote, all that separates whether of race, class, creed or sex is in whom you aim and must be overcome. You know, that sort of, for me, really sums up where I'd like this country to move forward.
It sounds like a very apt place to finish up, actually.
I think it's a really positive place to end. That was said many years ago. Why hasn't it happened yet?
Yeah. 125 years yeah. we're talking about here. Mm.
Mm. Change can take a long time. Yeah. Or it can happen quickly.
Yeah. I think sometimes, you know, we can't expect the system to change, but we can change ourselves and our approaches to it and create that reality ourselves. So, you know, if we're relying on, you know, the system to change, well, you know, that's going to take quite a while, but we can start agitating for that now.
Well, I'd like to say kia ora. Thank you so much to all of you for taking the time to share your very valuable insights into this topic. It's vast. We could have kept talking for a lot longer, I'm sure. But unfortunately, kua pō te wā, we're out of time. If you're listening to this, don't forget we have a Facebook and a Twitter account, and there are transcripts available as well. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.